No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host, Maria Sanchez, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So feel free to join in the conversation and call in at 888-627-6008, or you can Skype your questions in. And tonight we have a guest that we hope will be with us shortly, Officer Cariel Horn, and we'll tell you a little bit about her. But first, let me welcome my wonderful co-host and the most important person on Shadow Politics, Maria Sanchez.
You are too kind,
no,
Michael,
not
and
at
thank
all.
You very much. I appreciate that a lot. It's been a wild ride with you, 5.5 years now.
Oh, my God, I can't believe that, 5.5 years. And yeah. You've been so wonderful, Maria. You really have. You've made the show different than what it was. It started out as a conversation between me and a buddy of mine, Kathleen Gomez, and then you came on the show and everything has changed. It's become more professional. We've been getting great people on the show, and you deserve a lot of credit for that, and I so much appreciate it, because you know what? The idea behind the show, there's two ideas behind the show. One is that we want America to reach a consensus. And that's why we've gotten a Republican woman from the West Coast and a Democratic guy from the East Coast to show that we have more in common, more that brings us together than separates us. That's number one. And number two, we want everybody in America to know that the people of District of Columbia do not have the same rights as all American citizens. And we're the only people in the world, the only democracy in the world that does this, and we have to end taxation without representation. So,
a terrible thing to say. Like, usually when you say, you know, we're the only, and it's like something extraordinary or exceptional or, you know, prophetic or a blessing. But no, not in the District of Columbia's cases, the only in the world to disenfranchise their citizens.
Yeah. You know, and over on Friday, we were delivered a serious blow as a Democrat stood up and said he would not support us.
Now, dear.
Yeah.
Really?
Now we passed a bill in the Senate in the House to make the district a state, and we're now in the Senate. And the only path that we have in the Senate is we would need to suspend the filibuster and get every Democrat to vote for this. But Joe Manchin of West Virginia has said he won't tamper with the filibuster and he won't support D.C. statehood. He says he wants a constitutional amendment. And there's two problems with the constitutional amendment. One is, no state has ever been admitted to the union with a constitutional amendment. It's never been done. That's number one. So it's an awful big hoop to make us jump through when, you know, it really has never been done before. That's number one. And number two, we've already tried it. We did a constitutional amendment back in the 80s, and we didn't get enough states to ratify it after it had been passed by both houses of Congress. So, you know, giving us our equal rights shouldn't be a popularity contest. You know,
agreed. Michael, yeah, why don't you let the listeners know, because we're great attracting new listeners every week, which we're very grateful for.
Yeah.
So not everybody knows what the cause about DC for statehood is and what it means that you don't have statehood.
Yeah, well, you know, basically what happened when they set up the government is, you know, the founders, who were just brilliant people, they really were brilliant people, but this was an experiment, right? Democracy in America is the great experiment. They had no idea how it was going to go. So they didn't want women to vote because they were property at the time. Mm-hmm. They didn't want African Americans or Native Americans or even veterans who fought in the Revolutionary War. They couldn't vote unless they owned property. So there was a thing called the Philadelphia Mutiny of 1783. And a group of veterans surrounded Carpenter's Hall in Philadelphia, which was the seat of government in those days. Congress moved around in those days. They wanted their pension. They hadn't been paid for their service, and they called it a riot. I don't think anybody was hurt or anything, but they rioted, and Congress had to escape out the back door and run to New Jersey. And so when they came to Washington, when it came to finding a permanent capital, Madison argued that the Congress needed to be in control of the jurisdiction in which they reside, so that they could be protected from insurrection. Well, of course, given what happened on January 6th, we know that's not working for them anymore.
Right.
But that was the point. And so they gave Congress complete control over the District of Columbia. Now, there were only a few thousand people living here at the time, and it wasn't a big deal, I guess. And what happened is in 1801, Congress decided to take all the rights away from the people of District of Columbia. When the city was first established, it was established on land donated by Virginia and Maryland. So if you lived in the Maryland portion of the city, which is really what remains of the city today, you voted in Maryland elections. If you lived in the Virginia part, you voted in Virginia elections. Well, they changed all that with the Act of 1801, and they just took all the rights away from people in the district. And that's the way it stands today. We have no voting representative in the House of Representatives. We have no voting senators in the United States Senate. We do not have control over our own local tax money. Congress gets to decide whether we can spend it doing this or that. And we have no control over our local laws. If we pass a law, it has to sit on Capitol Hill for 30 to 60 legislative days for the Congress to decide whether we can actually enact the law or not. 40 years ago, they gave the district home rule. They allowed us to elect a mayor and a council. But those people are still subjected to the rule of Congress. And I think the thing that I find most incredible, and I think most people do, is we weren't even allowed to vote for president. We couldn't.
Yeah, that's ridiculous. And how long did that last?
Lyndon Johnson was the first person we ever got to vote for. So that was the election in 1964. I believe in 1961, the 23rd Amendment was passed that allowed us to vote for president. But it wasn't until the election of 1964 that we actually got to do it. And even that, strangely enough, is limited. We only get as many electoral votes as the smallest state. So at one point, we had 875,000 people, and we were entitled to 4 electoral votes, given our population. Mm-hmm. But we only got 3 because Wyoming only gets 3, and they were the smallest state. So even that is limited.
It's almost insanity. Like, I wouldn't believe it unless you're, but it's you who's telling the story.
Well, you know, And the thing, Maria, is that the Constitution of the United States is such a great document that 11 countries have actually copied it. They've used it as a, you know, as a shell, an outline for their own constitutions. And in every single case, they've taken out Article 1, Section 8, which we call the District Clause, which gives their government control over the capital city. All 11 countries have taken that out of their constitution. We're the only ones that haven't. So, yeah, so it's really crazy. And what it's become is a partisan battle. The problem
and with, that's the thing that I think you'll help the listeners understand even better, which I don't get, because as you mentioned, being a Republican in a very blue state, I'm an anomaly. But I'm also about what is right and what is fair and what is just. Yeah. And the argument is that the District of Columbia is, what, 98% Democrats there?
Yeah, it's like a ridiculous. We're more Democrat. You know, we voted for Joe Biden like 96% and Hillary Clinton for 94%, which I think is, you know, more people than voted for who knew her personally.
And so the argument then goes that any of your representatives would be Democrats, which would mean two more of everything, Democrats. And I'm like, okay, but that's another situation. Maybe more Republicans would move into the District of Columbia if you did have statehood. I mean, so, but regardless.
Nobody's taking the voting rights away from the people in Utah because they keep on electing Republicans, you know, And actually, a lot of people might not know this, but when South Dakota, you know, there's a book called How the States Got Their Shapes, and it's really interesting. It was done by a teacher who tells a story about how each state came into the Union after the original 13 colonies. And Dakota was one state full of Republicans. And they split it in half to North Dakota and South Dakota, even though they had a small population in those days, so that they could get four Republican senators instead of two. Mm. So it's always been a partisan thing. And you know what? I've been a Democrat my whole life, Maria, my whole adult life. And you know, I'm not I don't cast aspersions at the Republicans. I mean, if all the voters in the District of Columbia were Republicans, the Democrats would be putting up opposition as well. You know, we're not high and mighty about it. We understand it, but it's just not right. And lately they've been saying crazy things. Like one congressman, when we just passed a bill in the House, and one congressman said, well, you know, you're not a state. You don't have an airport and you don't have a car dealership. How can you be a state? That's actually not true. We do have a car dealership. But the point is, guess how many states came into the Union without a car dealership or an airport? 45 states. 45
states. Have Reagan? Isn't that
considered a city? Yeah, we do, but it's technically in Virginia.
Is it?
You know, like a lot of big airports are, right?
Okay,
big city airports that are close to a line, you know, but they're in the suburbs. But we do have Reagan, but 45 states were admitted to the Union without an airport or a car dealership. And you know how I know this? Because 45 states came into the Union before the invention of the car or the airplane. Right. So, you know, they couldn't have. And they also said, we don't have a bowling alley. And only New York had a bowling alley until, like, you know, 1890 or something. So most states also came in without a bowling alley. But that's how crazy it's gotten, you know. And one of our problems, and I'll tell you what I did today, one of our problems is we keep on going down this rabbit hole. They said we don't have a car dealership. So they had a rally at a Tesla dealer to show that we had a car dealership. And I'm saying to myself, how crazy is this? Yeah. Why should we, you know, should
we
say,
prove yourselves.
Oh, what? Yeah, right. So we don't have a car dealership. You know, I wrote a letter to publish a thing on Twitter to the guy that said the thing about bowling alleys, and I said, you know what? give us statehood, I'll pay to build a bowling alley. We'll build a bowling alley. We'll name
and
it
since
after
when
you.
Is that the yeah. floor of what is required for a state? Yeah. I mean, really, it's you know. If it weren't so tragic, it would be a comedy. But it's your lives are hanging in the balance, and yeah. your rights.
And you know what? That's one thing that even Washingtonians don't understand, that Congress has control, and it has done things like cost several lives. For example, we had a bill to do needle exchange at the height of the AIDS epidemic. Now, the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta said that that's the best way to control AIDS among drug users, because you can imagine, you know, you might have sex with one person, but if you're sitting in a room with a bunch of junkies and you're sharing a needle, you can infect a dozen people, you know,
right.
that one. So we started a needle exchange program. There were conservatives in Congress that didn't like it. So every year they took it out. Every year for 10 years, they took that out of our budget so that we could never implement it. And in that period of time, we became the number one place in America for AIDS cases. Then after they finally relented, after we reached that horrible statistic, in the next 3 years, deaths from AIDS from injectable drugs went down by 90%. So we know several people died because we couldn't put that into effect.
Right.
And recently, when we had the insurrection at the Capitol, our mayor does not control the National Guard. Your governor controls the National Guard. Every governor controls the National Guard, but our mayor doesn't control the National Guard. So they weren't called out, and she couldn't call them out. She called out the D.C. cops who helped. But, you know, at the end of the show, I'm going to tell you a little thing that I did today. But right now we have Officer Horn with us. Thank goodness.
Yay.
Great to have you on the show. Cariel, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Okay, good. Thank you so much for being on the show. Let me tell our listeners a little bit about Officer Cariel Horn. Officer Horn, who was an officer in the Buffalo Police Department, responded. We're going to let her tell you the whole story, but she responded to a call where she intervened when an officer had a white cop. Had an African American man named Neil Mack in a chokehold, and she intervened and very likely saved Mr. Neil's life by making the officer back off. She was vilified for this. She was fired. She was sued. She's going to tell us the whole story. And since then, she's become an advocate for police reform, I guess we should say. We'll let her use whatever term she wants. But she is a single mother of five children. Amazing. I have three children. I don't know how you have five children without going crazy. And she received the Harriet Tubman Award from the Erie County Legislature and was named Person of the Year by WUFO Radio. She received a Shiro Award for Excellence in Community Service from the Los Angeles Urban Police Roundtable and was named Emojis Woman of the Year. And we welcome her to the show. Thanks, Officer Horn, for being with us today.
And I might interject, Officer Horn, that this happened in November of 2006.
Yeah.
Yes,
the incident.
Yes, it did. Happened in November, like you said, 2006. And I was fired in May of 2008.
And you know, first of all, one has to ask if there had been an officer like Officer Horn when George Floyd was arrested, if George Floyd might still be with us today.
Mm-hmm.
So can you explain to us briefly? I mean, tell us about the incident. What exactly happened, officer?
Well, I went to assist with an officer in trouble call. When I got there, there were a lot of officers there. I walked in. There was a young man on the floor holding his face, an officer standing over him with a nightstick. I looked to the right, and there was Neil Mack, who was being punched in the face. He was handcuffed and being punched in the face. I didn't know what happened at that point. I helped get Neil Mack out of the house, and when I helped get him out, after I helped get him out, that is when we were walking to our patrol cars, and Gregory Kwiatkowski, like, swung him around and just started choking on him. So I yelled, "Greg, you're choking him." He didn't stop, so I grabbed his arm from around Neil Mack's neck. At that point, he came and punched me in the face and caused me to have my replace my bridge. My dental bridge. And to this day, I suffer from migraines because of it, but they would not allow me to press any criminal charges on him. Then he turned around and sued me for $65,000. And because the attorney that I had at the time didn't tell me that I had court, I didn't show up. So he got a $65,000 judgment.
Wow.
$20,000 of what he got, what he has already received. And so now he's coming after me for the rest.
That's incredible. And
just with that encounter, Officer Hearn, I understand too that you had some rotator cuff issues from other officers at the scene. Can you share how that happened?
Well, they pulled me back because after he punched me, then I got ready to defend myself, but then two officers got in between me and between us, and two officers was behind me. So two officers pulled me back and two officers stood between us.
And on what grounds were you fired, officer? Because, I mean, did they actually fire you because you, and they said it was because you intervened?
Yeah, they said that I intervened, but it's clear that he was already handcuffed in the house, so I knew he was under arrest. There was no reason for me to intervene with an arrest. And like I just said, there were two officers that got between us and two officers that pulled me back. So how could I be on his back if they got between us and we were face to face?
Let me ask you something. What was the makeup of the Buffalo police in those days? I mean, were there many women? Were there many African Americans? Were you an exception?
Yeah, actually, there were a good number. Mm-hmm. There were a good number of African Americans. At the call, there were black and white officers. I think it was about 18 officers that were there at the time. Officers say they didn't see anything or, you know, they were doing different things. I mean, there were officers who said that they saw him choking Neil Mack. He said he choked Neil Mack. But yet he sued me to say that I defamed him when I said that he was choking Neil Mack, which is what he was doing. But because you have that blue wall of silence, and you have corruption that goes to the top. You know, they it's not that they didn't believe what I said. It didn't matter. They had control over the officers. They had control over testimony. They had control over everything. So they made the story be however they wanted it to be.
Well, you know, I told you off the air, officer, and let me recount this very quickly, that when I was a teenager, when I was 18, I was beat up by two D.C. police officers. We took the office, not anything like what you're talking about or what George Floyd went through, but I did get beat up. We took the officer that actually beat me up before a review board. And I got to tell you, it was in a police station, so there were I don't know, dozens of cops there. And every cop that testified that they lied about everything. I mean, it was just incredible. And in fact, my sister was my lawyer. She was an attorney in D.C. And at one point they asked, you know, I was beaten up. I had bruises all over me and contusions. And she was a lawyer, so she took pictures of all this and got a medical report. And she said to the cop that beat me, why did you do it? You know, because obviously you'd done it. And he said, well, I went for his gun and tried to remove his gun. And when I tried to remove his gun and use it against him, he had to restrain me. And my sister said to him, are you telling me, officer, that my brother assaulted you, went to get your weapon and tried to murder you with it, and you had charged him $5 for disorderly conduct? And the cop said, he seemed like a nice kid and we didn't want to see him get in trouble. And we just stood there with our mouths open. Even the district attorney who would have prosecuted on our behalf said, we know these guys aren't telling the truth, but the truth of the matter is your brother was in the wrong place at the wrong time. And he got slapped around, and that's that. We're not going to prosecute it. But even the DA said, yeah, that, you know, obviously he didn't try to murder a cop, or he would have been charged with something. But yeah, so there really is that pressure, right, for all them to stick together?
Well, it is. It's the same thing that Greg said about Neil Mack. He said he grabbed for his weapon, but that wasn't true. Yeah. And well, even if it was true, there were enough of us there to control the situation. So even if he felt like, okay, he's trying to grab for my weapon, and then he tried to stop him, you know, once I yelled to him, like, you're choking him, that would have been it. You know, it should have been it. Should have been like, okay, so now I have somebody here to help me. I don't have to restrain him with a chokehold anymore.
Well, and didn't we see this with George Floyd, right? There were plenty of cops there. I mean, George Floyd was a big man, but I can't imagine that in handcuffs on the ground with four or five police officers standing around him, that they couldn't have adequately restrained him. Well, let's
well, that's just because they always formulate scenarios to make people believe, oh my God, like, oh, your job is so dangerous. Yeah. And then they say, oh, he was fighting with me. It's like, no, you're the one that's fighting. This person is in handcuffs.
Right.
Yeah.
The one thing, this is Maria Sanchez, by the way, Officer Horn.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's okay because we missed out at the beginning of the program. But what I would like to say is also tell our listeners about the timing of your firing, which is also egregious and disgusting.
What do you mean by the timing?
Because you were fired as you were about to go into another chapter in your life, is my understanding.
Retirement.
Yes.
And retirement, yes. So, I needed a couple of months before I had 20 years.
Wow.
But they basically forced me to go off of injury on duty, even though they forced me to have a hearing while I was in an arm sling. They're not supposed to take you off of injury on duty and force you to have a hearing so that they can fire you, but that's what they did. So my arm was in an arm sling, and I had to show up for the hearing, and then they forced me to come to work, the day before, well, this is before my arm was in an arm sling. The day before my surgery, they forced me to come to work. Well, anyway, it was before the surgery. They forced me to come to work to pack masks in a bag. So they have to constantly use my arm to pack the mask. Mm. And then the day after surgery, they forced me to come back to work. And then the deputy commissioner, who's now the commissioner, says, why don't you have your shirt on? Here I am in pain with the a big ice machine, and I didn't want to go. I said, I am not about to play these games. This is what I said to my attorney at the time. I am not about to play these games. I am in pain.
He says, you have to. And I went to work in pain, and he says, why don't you have your shirt on? Don't you see the arm sling? Don't you see the machine? But they didn't care. The only thing they wanted me to do was suffer.
Well, you know, let's tell Officer Horn, let's tell the good part of the story that after many years in court, you've finally been vindicated. You just won a lawsuit, did you not?
Yes, I did. So the judge, he overturned the firing, and he wrote a very good decision in which he put thought into it. He quoted Dr. Martin Luther King and said that I'm trying to think of the quote. It's always the right time to do the right thing.
It's hard to quote Dr. King because he said so many brilliant things. It's hard to keep them all straight.
And we should let our listeners know this just happened last month.
Yeah. This is new, right?
It's the 13th of April.
Wow.
So it hasn't even been a month yet.
So the decision was vacated and the back pay was approved and you're now pension eligible.
Yes. So
and that's since
the attorneys are working out the kinks. Excuse me?
That's since 2008.
Yes.
That's a long time.
I would imagine it's especially a long time with five children. How old are your children? Are they all?
Well, they range in age from 37 to 16. So they're
so you still have a 16-year-old at home.
Yes.
Yeah. 16-year-olds, as I remember, if I can remember that far back, are pretty expensive.
And they know it all.
Well, they do.
Boy, do they know it all.
So for most of his life, you have been fighting this decision that happened in 2008.
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah. Wow. It's difficult to believe. I don't want to sound like a Pollyanna, naive and all, but what's right is right. And you finally get vindicated, but in between from 2008 to 2021, that's a long time.
That is a long time. I went through emotional, physical, mental ups and downs. I tried to do the best that I could for my children. We were homeless. So, to have to go to a low like that, I was like a teenage mom. So to finish high school on time, start college at 17, and, I got on the police department at the age of 20. So to do all of that and then to be fired right when I can retire, that's a whole nother punch in the face.
Yeah.
Of course it is. Well, let me ask you, since you've been so involved as an advocate, officer, what are the things we need to do? What are some of the things you think we need to do to reform the, the police department? I think the term defund the police scares people. But what do you think are the things that are most important for us to do?
Well, I agree with defund the police, and even though people may be scared by the term, they need to understand, and I say understand what I mean by it. What I mean is that we take money from the police, we're giving them more money to buy weapons to use against us. So it doesn't make sense that you have a peaceful protester who's protesting police brutality, and they're met with more brutality with pepper spray and rubber bullets. Yeah. So I say defund the police, take money out of their budget, put it into the community budget. In Buffalo, New York, you have $140 million going to the police budget, and then you have $4 million going to the community budget. That's a little off. So you should be able to go into your community and get services before going, before being arrested and going to court, these services should be in your community anyway, so that you don't have to go to court first in order to say, in order for the judge to say, hey, you need to go to rehab, or hey, you need to go take parenting classes, or hey, you need to pay these tickets or whatever. I mean, this, it should be something that's in the community already. People have issues, especially if you live in a poor neighborhood. We're already over-policed, so we don't need more money in the budget for them to do harm to us. But when you look at it, one police-initiated arrest creates so many jobs in the justice system that they just don't want to stop it. You know, so if I am a police officer and I say, you know what, you look suspicious, come here, show me your ID. And then I decide, you know what, I don't like your attitude. Put your hands behind your back. And now I'm having a hard time getting the cuffs on your back because maybe you had rotator cuff surgery. Your arm doesn't go back the way someone who hasn't had rotator cuff surgery does. So now, oh, why are you fighting with me? And the person's like, I'm not fighting with you. My arm can't go back like that. And then I wind up just like breaking your arm. I'm just giving an example. Breaking your arm, putting the cuffs on you, and taking you to jail, and then charging you with resisting. And then you take a plea, knowing that you did nothing wrong except you were just walking down the street. And for whatever reason, the cop says, hey, you look suspicious. So I also believe that police officers should get a psychological exam yearly or whenever there's trauma or whenever they feel like they may need it. So, yeah. I mean, or
great point.
When other officers may see that they need it, because other officers on the department, they know who the bad apples are. They know who doesn't seem right. You know, they may not know that an officer may be going home beating on his family, but they can see that, you know, when they go on calls that, you know, instead of de-escalating, they escalate situations. So it's a lot of different things that can be done from within. We just have to erase that blue line. And that's the problem that we have, because the blue line doesn't stop with just police officers. You know, it goes with the higher-ups who are also covering up what's going on.
And there's also Cariel's Law, but before we go into that, we have Laura from Buffalo with
from
a question
Buffalo.
For you, Officer Horn, on line three.
Okay.
Laura, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Hello, Officer Horn.
Hello.
First of all, I'd like to say that I'm so sorry this all happened to you. It kind of basically sucks that you did the right thing and got, you know, deprimanded
punished.
For it. It was sad.
Couldn't have said it better. Go ahead.
Second, I'd like to say, it's now that everything you've gone through, I mean, this is years worth, looking back and knowing what you just went through, would you do it again? Would you?
Most certainly I would, because when you look at George Floyd and Eric Garner, they are no longer with us. Neil Mack, he still lives. So if I had nothing else to be proud of in my life, I could be proud that a man lived, because I chose to not stand behind a blue wall of silence.
Wow.
And I'm sorry, Laura, do you have anything else?
Yes. Also, now what's on the horizon for you? What are you going to do now?
Well, I want to have Cariel's Law, which we didn't talk about Cariel's Law yet on this show. But Cariel's Law is a law that I wrote back in, actually, I was looking at a Facebook post and I had it in 2015. I keep saying 2016, but in 2015 I made a post because, you know, I wanted people to know that there are solutions. You always hear the problems. So I, you know, was basically making a suggestion that, you know, officers be able to stand up against the police brutality. And that's what Cariel's Law is. It's the duty to intervene. And it calls for punishment for officers who don't intervene and, the falsifying of reports. Everything that I went through, I pretty much didn't want another officer to have to go through when they are attempting to do the right thing, or if they are doing the right thing, or if they are reporting bad officers. So I basically tried to come up with a solution, or did come up with a solution. And I said, in order for officers to cross that blue line, they may have to be forced to do it. And how can I get them, how can I force them to do it? Because if police brutality is going on, just like we see in the George Floyd case, none of the bystanders could have done anything. They would have been either hurt or locked up also, mm-hmm. or possibly dead. So the only people there that could have stopped the police brutality were other officers. So I was thinking, how do I get that to be something that they have to do? And that's why I wrote the law.
And where is it?
But it needs to have a national registry. Okay. It needs to have a national registry. So that's why I want to push it nationally or even globally. Because if someone in Buffalo, New York is a bad officer and they decide to go to, let's say, Wisconsin, I'm just giving an example, then they get a job there. They don't know that they're a bad officer, but if we have this national registry, then they can't just hop from department to department.
And, you know, we've had that situation. First of all, thank you, Laura, for calling in. We've had that situation right here in Washington. We've had a situation in Maryland where there was a cop that was fired for several violent encounters from a police department in Connecticut, I think. And then he got a job with the Howard County as a Howard County police officer and was involved in another incident where somebody had died. And it really shocked me that, you know, I assume they do a background check and everything on officers, that people didn't know this. So, you know, when
it's
they hire
It's not uncommon.
Evidently it's not uncommon. So let me ask you, as Cariel's mm-hmm. law, has that passed in New York?
Yes, it has passed in Buffalo, New York. It passed in October of 2020. And so now I am trying to push it in other states. It needs to, like I said, it needs to be a federal law. But, you know, we have to just chip at it city by city, state by state. And if there's anyone who can help me, hint, hint, then maybe we can have that passed on a federal level.
When you say it passed in Buffalo, New York, does that mean that it's not prevalent in the state of Buffalo, but it just, I mean, sorry, the state of New York, but only in the city of Buffalo?
Right.
Oh, wow. So that's where yep. carrielslaw.com comes into play. So why don't you let our listeners know how
exactly.
they can get involved? Yeah.
Okay. So if you go to carrielslaw.com, you can give to the GoFundMe. I'm serious. It is there, but... You can go to the bottom, and it has a spot where you can sign up, try to get it passed in your city, state, town, or even, like I said, on a federal level.
So the GoFundMe is raising resources to help this happen, or does the GoFundMe
also?
Yeah,
because I want to go. If someone is interested, I'm ready to, I will just want to go. I want to be able to say, here, this is what you need. Here, we can do Zooms. We can do, if you need me there, then I can be there. Whatever. I just want it to be passed because it says Cariel's Law, because it could be whatever name. It could be the George Floyd Act. But the point is, we need it to be passed because it will save lives. Because if you have officers who are not going to stand by and let the bad officers be in control, and they're going to have the duty to intervene, then they will.
And I don't know if you know or not, but the GoFundMe page is disabled.
Well, it shouldn't be, but no, I didn't know that. I have to check and see what's going on.
Because I did go onto it, and it said this fundraiser is no longer accepting donations.
Well, that might be the old one. Because I didn't take it down. The old one I didn't take down because of the comments. I wanted to respond to people, and I haven't had time to go through them yet. But there is another one that I did. The one that would be good is the one under my name. I was the one that set it up because I had so many people set up GoFundMes in my name, so I don't know who they are.
So there is another link that is live. So just
yeah,
I wanted the listeners to know.
It should be on the carryoutlaw.com. Excuse me?
I just want our listeners to know not to be confused that there is one that is still active.
Yes, it is.
Yes, there is one. Can you hear me?
Well, yeah.
Yes.
Yes, under carryoutlaw.com, if you go on there and then you scroll down, it says an official GoFundMe, and that one is active.
Well,
to try to make the other one inactive, but I just didn't want to close it out because I wanted to keep the comments.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't know how we can help you here in Washington, Officer Horn, but I'm sure after we get off the air, we should continue to talk to each other. And if there's something that I can do to help you in your quest to get this, made into a national law, or at least have more states accept Carrier's Law, I would be happy to do that. I think you come at this. I'm going to give you a little free advice here, which is worth what you pay for it. But I think you come at this at just the right time.
Yes.
I think, thing about George Floyd, which, as a police officer, maybe this wouldn't be too unusual to you. But for me, I think we all watched that man be executed. And that was, I think that left an indelible impression on the American people that we actually saw this man. We saw that officer with total disregard, with people pleading with him, bystanders. And we saw this man murdered on national television. And I think that really struck a chord with all of us. And I think we all understand that that's not every cop. We all know good cops, obviously. I've got one on the
radio. You have a lot of great officers.
Right now. Yeah, a lot of great officers. I've worked with the D.C. police forever. But we obviously need to get people like Officer Chauvin. We need to find him something else to do and not
like being a prison cell.
Yeah, like being a prison cell, which is where he's going now and where he should be. And we'll see, and especially, what's coming up. I think that's really important to what you're doing in Carrier's Law. Let's see what they do with those other cops that stood around and did nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's a way to motivate people to change the laws, to say, you may be liable if you stand behind the blue wall. Maybe it's time for the blue wall to come down. Well, let me ask you, because we're almost out of time here. I need a couple minutes at the end of the show to discuss something. But let me ask you, is there something that we haven't mentioned, Officer Horn, that you'd like to say?
I just want to thank people for their support from before and going forward. And I want people to understand that I am not anti-police. I am anti-police brutality or when police are doing the wrong thing. So I encourage officers to do the right thing, and I do understand why some are hesitant to do and say anything. That's why we need Carrier's Law, because if they don't intervene, when they see things are done wrong, then they probably won't if they're not forced to do it. That's why we need Carrier's Law, because then I don't know. I guess we have bullies on the police department who bully other police officers, which is not a good thing.
Yeah. Well, and you know what? If there's anybody that I feel a little sorry for, I guess, it's the cop that was there in Minnesota that was on his first day of the job.
Yes.
It was his first day of the job, right? I could see that, and so it would protect people like him. It would protect people like him that really aren't sure what to do, right? Because it's the first day out on patrol, your first day on the job.
Well, one thing I can say is I do feel a little bad. Yeah. I do feel a little bad for him. But number one, he was a trained officer. Number two, he was an adult.
Yep.
So although I do feel bad for him, and that was the culture that he walked into, he had a duty to be a human being first.
I agree.
So he would not have liked that to happen to himself, his father, grandfather, brother, cousin, anyone that he loved. So
you're right.
You have a duty. You have a duty to be humane first. So although I feel bad for him, George Floyd is dead. He's not coming back.
That's right. And you know what? And I think the jury will see it that way, too. I think in the end, they'll see it exactly the way you just mapped it out. Well, let me tell you something, Officer Cariel Horn. You're a hero in my book.
Absolutely.
I saw your picture when you're a police officer. It's not like you're 6'4" and, you know, you intervened in what must have been a very dangerous situation for you. And you knew it was a dangerous situation when you did it. But you did it anyway, because, as you just said, first you were a human being. And that's really what we need to demand from our police officers. So thank you very much. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you for having me. Congratulations.
Yeah. Congratulations Marvelous. On your victory. Please give us your website one more time so people can come.
Okay, it's carioslaw.com.
All right.
C-A-R-I-O-L.
Yes.
Yeah, and you know what? We'll put that on BBS Radio. So if you don't have a pen and you're not writing it down, you can go to our website and we'll make sure it's up there. Okay?
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. You have a great evening, and thanks for being with us.
Thank you, and I really appreciate you having me. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Take good care.
We'll talk to you in the future. Okay, now, America, I've got one thing to tell you. Cariel came on while I was about to discuss this, but today I put up a 6 by 4 foot billboard-looking sign in my front yard.
Because it reads,
warning, you are entering the District of Columbia, the nation's capital. Caution, residency may result in the loss of your basic civil rights. Be advised, revocation of your rights does not relieve your responsibility for obligations to the state for which you may be liable. Taxation without representation. And it's out there to let everybody know that when they come into the District of Columbia, my house is the first house you pass coming down a major thoroughfare, and you come into the District of Columbia, that this is the situation we're in. So I want all our listeners out there to go to my Twitter account, SenMDBrown, pick up the little video I put on there and put it out on social media. Let's make this a national issue.
And I retweeted it. So I just thought it's like perfect. The senator, a troublemaker.
That's what we were told to do. Make good trouble. Trouble the water. That's what we want to do. And that's what, one of my heroes, Representative John Lewis from Georgia used to say, make good trouble. And that's what we want to do. And thank you, Maria Sanchez, for being a good troublemaker with me.
Of course, my pleasure and honor.
And we'll see you. And we're going to dedicate a song, as we always do at the end of the show, to our guest, Officer Horn, and to all the good cops in America. Because please understand, we know there are plenty of good cops out there who like Cariel Horn, who went into public service. They went in there to be a public servant.
To protect and to serve. Job
to protect and to serve. That's absolutely right. And I know you know a lot of them, Maria, and I know a lot of them too. Mm-hmm. I grew up in a working class neighborhood. So here's Alicia Keys with We Gotta Pray. Because we do, America, we gotta pray. Thanks.